This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Been so wonderful about writing to me that I think it's my turn to write to you. I wish I could write a letter to each one of you individually, but since time does not allow me that privilege, I'd like to take this means of writing a letter to you. If you'll excuse me now, I'm going over to my other keyboard and start writing this letter. George, have you got some letter writing music? Okay. Just a minute, George.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And that was Liberace playing the typewriter song, which leads on to my guest this week, Lewis Parker, writer, publisher and poet. Good afternoon, Lewis.
Thanks for having me on, William.
Why? What's the relevance? Why would I have played Liberace's typewriter song?
Well, because you love it, obviously. It has such a magical feeling.
Absolutely. Well, the first time I encountered you was on the bank of the Thames, the south side, near the Globe Theatre.
Yep.
And I walked past and noticed that you were sitting there with a typewriter.
That's correct, yep.
And you have a pitch there where you basically you invite people to pay for a poem to be typed out on the spot.
That's right, yeah. It's spontaneous composition, improvisation, poet for hire, pay what you like.
Poet for hire, that's what you call yourself.
Pay what you like, that's the important part. If the authorities are listening, there is no set fee. I am not street trading. It's a voluntary donation.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Otherwise, oh, I see. How would it work? What would happen then if you had a set fee, if you said £5 for a poem,
yeah,
you'd be a street trader.
I'd be a street trader and it would come under some different kind of regulation. But also giving people the chance to pay what they want makes it more accessible and it puts me under less pressure.
Right.
I don't want to put a price on it.
Okay.
It puts a little bit of pressure back onto the customer because
right.
they are then, you know, their generosity is then tested and their spiritual metal is put under the microscope. So we're both scrutinized in this interaction.
Right.
And yeah, it also enables me, it frees me from the obligation to produce something which they think is worth a certain amount of money, which is not what art should be, obviously.
Right. It is art. You call it art? Is it
an art form, I guess.
An art form, okay. Are you an artist or a writer?
I think writing is an art form, isn't it?
Okay, all right.
It's an art and a craft, right. An obsession and I'll stick to that.
So what's the most anyone has, is that between you and your accountant?
That's between me and my accountant.
Have you had substantial payments? Have people been so delighted that they kind of say, wow, this is so great, I'm going to give you a load of money? Or does it tend to be like 50 pence or something?
No, I mean, I would say 50 pence is a very stingy contribution.
Absolutely, yes.
I always say a fair price. If people ask, I try not to get involved in naming a price, but if somebody really wants to know, I think a fair price is, you know, the price of a drink, depending on where you drink.
Right.
So it could be a coffee in Wetherspoons or it could be a glass of champagne at the Ritz, but okay. I've written you a poem, you buy me a drink. I think that's a fair exchange.
Right. And it's always on a typewriter, presumably, because that's portable and you don't have to plug it in.
Exactly, yeah. I do get some people come up to me and think they're being extremely witty and incisive when they ask me, why don't I use a laptop?
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe some people assume that I am a Luddite who doesn't own a computer when...
Right.
Obviously, right. This is just a pragmatic decision to be able to type things in a legible manner. It's portable, I don't have to plug it in.
Yeah.
And also some people undeniably come to the Poet for Hire stall purely for the kitsch of having something that is written on a what they would call a vintage or a retro typewriter, when obviously these are the only ones in existence. So I'm not doing it for the retro appeal. It's just a coincidence.
Is it a very particular typewriter?
It is. It's an Olivetti Latura 22.
Right. And is that something quite special or...?
No, it's a mass market 1950s Olivetti. I have a 22 and I have a 32. They're almost identical. And I think this is the typewriter of choice of Leonard Cohen, Cormac McCarthy, and in Don DeLillo's Americana, his first novel, the protagonist in that, he uses an Olivetti Latura 32.
Okay.
So those are my typewriters of choice.
Right. It's quite a smart-looking thing. It's sort of, what's that shade of green? It's a kind of turquoise or a duck egg blue, perhaps.
Yeah, a duck egg blue or a turquoise green.
Right. And is this a fair weather occupation? I imagine you tend to come out perhaps when the weather's good and there's plenty of people passing by.
Yeah. I mean, until recently, I think the warm weather, it was so hot that people just wanted to get into the shade. But generally speaking, we are solar-powered, so... If, you know, the sunnier it is, the more willing people are to stand around for 5 minutes and wait while you tap out a poem for them. Whereas if it looks like it's about to rain, then they want to rush on to wherever they're going.
Yeah. And it's true, I think, that most, if not all, well, probably most of your poems are what are called acrostics.
I wouldn't say that most of them are acrostics. I would say that when people don't have a topic or a title... that isn't related to themselves, I kind of reluctantly allow them to title their poem after their own name, and I type them an acrostic.
Right. And an acrostic being that their name is written vertically.
Yes.
And the first line of each...
The first letter of each line spells out their name when you read it down the side of the page. And I do it in red as well, so you've kind of got a two-dimensional message. And sometimes you try and describe the person with the acrostic, or sometimes you make up something that's wildly inaccurate just for the laugh.
Right.
But it's like an abstract portrait of the person.
Yeah.
And people tend to be really happy with it, which is kind of strange, because when I started doing them, I thought... You know, this is the first poetic form you learn in primary school. People are going to think that this is infantile or inadequate somehow. But it turns out that they really love it, because it shows that certainly if you put the words together in the right order, with a little bit of elegance, then they know that you haven't pre-written it. Because
right. And each one is unique, presumably. They go away with the only copy of it.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
You don't sign it or anything?
I've got a stamp. My publisher, Morbid Books, has its own signature. I like to stamp it with that for a little bit of personal branding.
Right.
And to send people towards the website where if they like that poem, maybe they could buy a book of stuff.
So how long have you been doing this?
I think it's 3 or 4 years.
And do you earn a living at it?
No.
Okay.
I do other stuff. This is a fair weather bank holiday. I don't know what you would call it. Somewhere in between a hobby and a Saturday job.
Right. There's a degree of performance about it, isn't there?
I mean, there is, yeah.
I mean, when I see you on the bank side, as I have, it looks like a sort of... I mean, there is a visual aspect to it, especially with this sign, say, Poet for Hire.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a little bit of performance art in a way.
It is.
Sort of, yeah.
I mean, that's an element of it that I would get rid of if I could. I personally don't like being in public view. If it was feasible to do it behind a screen or to put a bag over my head, then I would do that. But it turns out that people with bags over their heads aren't very approachable.
that's true.
Okay. But I do wear some form of, not elaborate, but a mild form of costume or disguise.
Right.
Just because...
You're very well turned out today. You've got a Hawaiian shirt on and a smart hat with a little feather on the side.
Yeah, it's important to look good on the radio.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you are the publisher. Well, hopefully during the programme, we're going to get a couple of people down from the office.
Yeah, get them down.
And they
drag them down here against their wishes.
Whoever is up there. Should they be willing, and they will either give you a topic or their name or something, and hopefully you can improvise a poem on air and type it out on air. You've got the typewriter here in front of you. So there's certainly Sarah is up there and Francisco, so we can get them in. But you're not going to, you won't read them out if you don't like them, I think you said.
I think that's... I don't think it would be to anyone's benefit to be reading out garbage like that.
No, unless
there is some sort of...
There can't be garbage. I'm sure your poems are never garbage.
Oh, believe me, they are. I mean, if you were writing 30 or 40 pieces of music or 30 or 40 drawings or 30 or 40 of anything in a day, some of them are bound to be garbage, and I think you have to learn to embrace that. I mean, my attitude is if I write one good one a day and 49 pieces of garbage, I've written one good poem. It was successful.
Right.
And you can pay what you like for it. So if you don't think it's any... If people don't think it's any good, they haven't lost anything apart from the 5 minutes they had to wait around in the glorious sunshine.
Right.
But
so how did you get into poetry? What's your background? Are you a literature student or art student or...
No, I did a postgrad in literature and creative writing, but my first degree isn't in that. My first degree is in political science.
Okay, right.
So that's what I do for my day job. I teach that.
Oh, do you? Oh, you teach political science?
Well, politics, government, media studies at school and university,
Where do you teach?
I'm not going to reveal the name of the school because it would be embarrassing for my students. But I was doing some at Portsmouth University for a bit, but now I've, keeping it close to home.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting aspect. Because you have brought some of your books in, which we can talk about and look at later, and some of them certainly have a political slant.
Yeah.
You are associated to some extent with Stuart Home.
Yes.
Who is also, is it fair to say he is of a somewhat anarchic nature?
Yes. He's quite particular about his politics. I think he would say that he is definitely not an anarchist.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't know how he would label his political affiliations, but they're definitely in that direction.
Yeah.
And I would say that my political affiliations are in that direction
that's probably a good position to have, I think.
professional troublemaker.
Right, okay. Cultural, I'm going to avoid the word. There is another cultural...
You're not allowed to swear on air.
No, it wasn't that. No, it's only beginning with T. But anyway, so you are the publisher of Morbid Books.
Yes.
And you have a title which has just come out, I think. Several titles, it seems.
Yeah.
Which you publish yourself? I mean, you pay for the publication yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I take pride in that sacrifice.
Right.
I don't accept any funding from anybody apart from, I guess, the people who donate money when I'm doing Poet for Hire. That's kind of why I'm out there on the South Bank busking, is to, you know, to pay for the printing of these books.
Right.
And the people who buy them, obviously. So,
yeah.
But there's no outside funding. I'm not Arts Council affiliated or anything like that.
No, I noticed on the book that there's no reference to any kind of funding. So this latest publication is called Poetry for the Poorly Educated.
Yep.
And released in May 2018, which just happens to be this month.
Today.
Is it coming out today?
Today.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Great. Okay.
I've literally just gone to the printers and picked them up.
Oh, right. Okay. So you can sign me a copy then?
Yep.
Do you do that, or is that too political?
I think signing books is... I think that's dabbling in the cult of the individual, which
exactly.
is something that I'm trying to get away from.
But you'll sign it for me.
Of course I'll do that
for you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. So the poems were composed while stationed as, and then in inverted commas, a literary prostitute or poet for hire at events and in the streets of London, New York, Paris, Berlin, Edinburgh and smaller towns. So you get around. And the book contains verse written for lovers, relatives and pets, alive and dead, poems to celebrate orgies, pleas to cheating husbands and their prostitutes, responses to Donald Trump and other apocalyptic events, and a selection of suicide notes.
That just about sums it up. It's almost like I wrote that summary myself.
Exactly. And... this leads nicely onto the subject of your core Morbid Books, mm-hmm. and we now have this reference of a selection of suicide notes. Do I detect a theme here, Lewis?
Possibly.
What's going on here?
Well, I will explain the context of the suicide notes in that when I first started doing this Poet for Hire thing, when my friend Tim Siddle, who is down at the South Bank now, if you want a poem, go down to the Millennium Bridge outside the Globe. He should be there holding the fort,
right,
sweating it out while I'm in here.
So is he also a poet for hire?
He is, yeah.
Oh,
there's actually two or three. There's three or four of us now.
Oh.
But he was the first and I joined him.
Right. What's his name?
Tim Siddle.
Siddle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Tim. You can't hear me because you're out there composing poetry, but if you're listening back, yeah.
We have a client, people are walking through the door now, customers for the Poet for Hire. We have Francisco. Shall I turn your mics up? Which numbers are these? Guest mic 2 and guest mic 3. I'm sorry, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Milo.
Milo. So Milo and Francisco have now joined us in the studio, and they are willing victims, clients of the Poet for Hire.
Yep.
So it's up to them to either, I don't know, I'll leave it to you. You play it from here, Lewis.
I was going to finish explaining about the suicide notes.
Yes.
So when I joined Tim on the South Bank with my typewriter, he already had the sign that said Poet for Hire, and I thought I couldn't copy him. So I came down there with a sign that said poems, stories, suicide notes and more.
Uh-huh.
I put it on there as a joke, and then people started coming up to me and asking for them.
Right.
And I don't, as a matter of principle, I won't turn down any commission.
Right.
So I started writing them. I think most people, to be fair, took it in the spirit that it was intended.
So you've written suicide notes for people?
Well, no, the spirit that it was intended is a joke, obviously.
Right.
I don't ever think anyone was actually suicidal
But you'll never know.
I'll never know. No, but that's their prerogative, isn't it?
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the context for the suicide notes. I've taken that sign down now, so right. I guess if someone came up to me and asked for a suicide note, there'd be much more.
It is a bit close to the bridge, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's kind of tempting fate a bit.
Yeah.
You know, somebody could come along and
it's
you
off
could
the
write.
Bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a bagpipe and set up next to me last week, and I almost wrote her a gratis suicide note.
Right.
She was standing right on the ledge of the river, and I was thinking that if there's one person I wanted to give a suicide note to, it was her.
I see. You don't like bagpipes.
Okay. No.
Or not her version of it, anyway. Okay, so how should we proceed with this impromptu poetry festival here?
I don't know. Milo, do you want to just give me a title or a topic, the first thing that comes into your head?
Time travel.
Okay. So it usually takes me about 5 minutes. And like we said, I think we agreed before, if it's garbage,
you won't read
I won't
it
read
out.
It. But the trouble is, I don't usually know if it's garbage until about an hour afterwards, because I have to sort of evaluate it in the clear light of day. So, to be honest, usually I'm sort of...
We won't judge you on it. We won't hold you to this. There's no critics listening.
I mean, I don't know what you want to do while I'm doing this.
Well, let's see how it goes. You can sort of... You don't have to do a Liberace. In the little film clip at the beginning, Liberace pauses and puts three candles on the typewriter. Like he used to have on his grand piano. He lights the three candles on the typewriter and then starts to play it. So we won't be doing that here today. But so now we've got Lewis composing a time travel poem for Milo. What do you do here, Milo, whilst we're on the...
I help run Resonance Extra with Peter Lansley.
Right.
Which is a new... even more experimental branch of the Resonance tree.
Okay. I don't know about this.
You
why
don't know.
Why don't I know about this? I've only been here 10 years.
Well, it's been going for 2 years now. Surprise.
I've probably heard about
you must
it,
have
but
heard
not really
about it, yeah.
Not really delved into it.
Yeah, we have our whole range of shows specifically for Resonance Extra.
Okay.
And started in Brighton, but just moved to... Or well, actually, I'm not... I won't say that, actually. I'm not supposed to say that yet.
Oh.
But there's some big movement that something will start broadcasting in London, but I'm not allowed to say anymore.
Oh, right. Well, that sounds enigmatic and mysterious, enticing. So Resonance Extra, how does that differ from anything else on Resonance? What's it all about?
Resonance Extra is, I think, far more international. Oh. For a start, it's not actually community radio, and it's unlike Resonance, which is likes to contextualise its imagery through its website, which is very word based. Resonance Extra is primarily based on imagery.
Right.
So we have hundreds and hundreds of very nice photographs and artworks sent in. If you go on the Resonance Extra website, the first thing you see is a whole page of of an image.
Right. Okay. And does it broadcast separately or in conjunction with?
Yes, entirely separately. Occasionally, we have programs that are live stream from FM to Extra.
Right.
I think this is now going live stream to Extra.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, that's good news.
I think.
I hear that the typewriter has stopped.
Yes. Okay. That's that.
We have a pause, a momentary pause. So I'm guessing that this means that the poem has been completed.
It has.
This particular one on time travel for Milo.
Yeah.
And will you be able to assess on the spot that it's worthy of reading?
I think it is.
Good.
It's certainly no worse than I would give out ordinarily, so
okay.
What the hell. Time travel. In the film clip at the beginning, Liberace lights three candles on the typewriter and sniffs the air pompously. When the smoke enters his bloodstream and shocks his brain, he is wriggling around on the floor of a Victorian opium den.
Wow.
Okay. Is that for Milo?
There you go, Milo.
Thank you very much.
You've got a sort of monogrammed... there is some sort of little logo at the bottom.
There is. Morbidbooks.net.
Right.
With, what is this?
It's a bent spoon.
It's a bent spoon. Looks good.
Good. Okay. Well, that's yours, Milo. So the next one up is Francisco.
Hello.
Francisco, what do you do here?
I'm a sound engineer at Resonance FM since 2015.
Right.
Yeah, helping running the shows and
yeah,
basically, yeah.
What's your surname?
Mazza.
How do you spell that?
M-A-Z-Z-A.
Okay. Francisco Mazza, who... Oh. Two Zs, perfect.
Yeah. No, let's choose a title.
That's the topic, though.
You've got to have a choose. You've got to choose a topic.
I'm going to choose a topic, okay. Yeah. I think about resonance. Doesn't need to be FM, but just resonance, the word.
Very appropriate.
Maybe there's some sonic elements on.
All right. So away we go again. We're going to have a brief 5-minute spell whilst Lois Parker composes a poem on the subject of resonance. Francisco, what's... I have encountered you at the Serpentine Gallery, haven't I?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Why does that make you laugh? Why does that make you laugh?
No, I don't know. It's a nice place.
Okay. That's something, is that something we can mention?
No, it's just a part-time job there.
Yeah, but yeah. I walk through the gallery and there you are motionless in the gallery. Like a performance art piece.
Like a performance art, yeah.
But
actually not being paid as a performer.
So what do they call you, an invigilator or something?
Yeah, something like this. No, there's a beautiful name for this, like a visitor experience.
Visitor experience assistant. Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds
because
grand.
Yeah. It's more than invigilating. You need to actually, I don't know, explain the work. Not explain, but contextualize sometimes the work to the visitors.
Okay.
And yeah.
What's on at the moment?
The moment? Yan Cheng.
Okay.
American Arts, work with digital and AI technology in the gallery.
All right. Okay.
And Sondra Perry. It's a very nice exhibition, Sondra Perry.
I thought there was a moment of writer's block there, but no, he's moved on.
The resonance.
I didn't know you worked at Serpentine Gallery.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Permanent installation.
Exactly. I've seen him there two or three times, but it's in the new one, isn't it?
Have you been there, the new one? No, not yet.
I've seen you in that. It's the one. What do you call it? It's a something or other gallery. It's not. Is it? It's not Sackler, is it? It's something or other, kind of like. Very particular.
I don't remember what is the projection. No,
but the gallery itself, the one that's at the far end of the that particular department. No, never mind.
No.
I thought it had a name, but it's the one with the restaurant next to it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Sackler Gallery in Serpentine Gallery. Yeah.
Right. Right.
That's right. Yeah. The restaurant's the Sackler Gallery.
Yeah. Okay. We could have a momentary pause to listen to the typewriter.
To the typewriter.
No pressure. Have you ever used a typewriter, you guys?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well, to write or for sound?
Out of choice? I mean, you kind of like you look too young to have experienced the world of typewriters. I mean, there was a time when you'd go into an office and all you heard was the clack, clack, clack
click,
of about
click, clicking,
50 typewriters, but that's a long time ago.
I think I was just mucking around with one that I found found in some attic.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Not for any serious reason.
No. Okay. Yeah. Did you take to it, or is it sort of...
I think I only really enjoyed the sliding across.
Right.
Because it has a little... The one that I used had a little bell.
The bell,
when
exactly.
You got to the end.
Yeah.
So I really like that.
Right. Francisco, have you used one?
I use for sound composition, for soundtrack.
Still use it?
No, I've used in one film, a specific film that recorded...
To write the soundtrack or to record?
No, to record the sound.
Oh, right.
To record the sound and then manipulate the sound.
Right.
So it's a kind of abstract written sound came from the typewriter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, right.
It's quite sonic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite a long one, this one.
It is, isn't it? It's going well. My God. Are we on to a second page? No?
No, we're only halfway down the first one.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, I happen to have, as a diversion, I brought in, the paper has been whipped out of the machine, and it's got its stamp.
Yep.
And we are assuming that this poem has also passed the test, quality control.
The very lax quality control test. So resonance. The madman ranting in front of 20,000 ideologues in the football stadium is making it up as he goes along. The teleprompter flashes with interruptions from his campaign manager, imploring him to mention the minimum wage, farm subsidies and the little people. His technical staff are experimenting with bright colours and zany fonts to try and get his attention. But he won't stop ranting about himself until they mention the magic word to him. Buttermilk.
Very good. Yes.
Thank you very much.
I think that's very good. Yeah. We like that one. Great. You did one for Bob Parks, didn't you, some time ago, and I brought it on, and I gave it to him on air, and he read it out. I mean, that was quite successful. That was an acrostic. Perhaps you don't know who Bob Parks is.
No.
No, you did. I asked you to do it on the bank side. But
what subject did you...
Well, it was his name.
Oh,
Bob
on
Parks,
just on Bob Parks,
as an acrostic, okay. And then it kind of went across from there, and that did work. So the next, we need Sarah to come down now. Do you think she's going to come in?
Oh,
she might do.
I've already done one for her.
Oh, have
she's
you?
Come. Yeah, yeah. She's coming down.
She's coming down.
I can hear some steps and stuff.
Okay, but you've done one in advance.
I did one in advance. Yeah, as a test before she came in, or before we were on air.
Sarah.
I sort of hijacked and preempted the title because I liked that card that was in the office.
Oh, the test card.
Yeah. So maybe I could feed you the title. What title would you like your poem to be?
Thank you,
Lewis. Lewis, may I please have I liked the test card?
You may.
Thank you, Lewis.
I think that's cheating. It's supposed to be improvised.
No, it was improvised. He walked into the office.
Done.
Boom.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
That's a flash of inspiration.
Well, I don't know. This leaves us somewhat lacking in conversation because it's all over. And you've only just sat down.
Okay, you carry on and converse then.
Well, let's hear the poem.
Okay. I liked the test card. I'm going to put you on hold. My TV has returned a memory from the age of wonder. It smells like mustard sandwiches, and the little girl grins at me like we are friends. The secret club we painted onto our faces while our parents talked about gardening.
I always thought the little girl looked a bit creepy on the test card.
Oh, gosh, yes, I'd forgotten about that. Oh. Yeah. Are there balloons involved?
No, there's a little, isn't there a little kind of, what looked like a 10-pin bowling pin kind of?
Oh.
It's a strange vortex of memory, that test card, because I think it's almost like a surrealist... Rorschach test. Is that how you say it?
Rorschach, yeah.
Yeah, Rorschach test of what objects you remember from that test card. So I remember the blackboard, and I think there's some face painting involved.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I remembered. And is it a clown or a monkey?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I thought it was like a 10-pin bowling pin kind of thing with a face drawn on it or something.
Gosh.
Yeah.
But has she got an arm around it or...
I don't know.
Ah, oh, this is awesome memory. Or not.
Well, it's...
But we had the test card in New Zealand as well, like after hours television. So
maybe yours was different.
No, I think the same, pretty much the same. I remember the same picture.
Yeah.
Creepy girl, temp and bowling thing.
Yeah.
Blackboard.
So it must be a universal symbol then. It must go all around the world, this image.
Mm.
With the sort of little grids around the side as well.
Yeah,
to see if your TV is in focus.
Yeah.
Okay.
70s televisions.
Yeah.
Do you remember the fluff and static used to get off them when you turn them off or turn them on? When you first turn them on.
I wasn't born in the 1970s.
Oh, all right.
Ooh. Ouch.
Gosh, shall I leave you?
There you go.
Thank you. I'm going to put that next to the I Like the Test Card, which is a Bob and Roberta Smith.
Please,
so that's going right next to it.
Great. Well, thank you, Sarah, for contributing to our Poets in Residence.
Thank you.
I think that's it. That probably, I don't think there's anyone else up there, is there, who could...
Well, there's Joe Cushy pre-recording a show, but he's pre-recording a show.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
So that's been three poems, three satisfied customers who will, of course, pay you at the end of the programme.
Well done, Lewis. A pint.
I'm not leaving until they do.
Okay. Well, we can go back to morbid books. You have one out today. Shall we talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, we have two out today. Poetry for the Poorly Educated and Stuart Holmes are coming out on the same day.
Oh, right.
Because there is some sort of thematic link between them, but this one's mine, so...
Okay, well, let's okay, so Stuart Holmes is called Send Cash, which is one of his slogans, as it were.
Yep.
Whenever you see his name, there's this sort of in block capitals, it says Send Cash.
Yeah.
Is that because he's just literally asking for money? He's just saying, here I am, send me money?
I don't know with him. It's often hard to know what's a joke and what's sincere and where that line is. But certainly on social media, he seems to have appropriated the voice of Nigerian money scammers and seems to enjoy playing that character.
But without offering you anything as such. I mean, like the Nigerian scammers seem to say that you've inherited sort of $66 million dollars in an offshore account or something.
I think he makes limited offers to people.
Right.
I don't think people have ever sent him that much cash because he's not a very good money scammer.
Okay. Well, let's hear about your book. The cover is a collage by a friend of yours?
The cover is a collage by the artist Shane Wheatcroft,
right,
whose work I came across on the internet. And I've never met him, but we've had some very... self-congratulatory conversations via email.
Right. Oh, you have never met him?
No.
Oh, right.
I just saw that image and said, I like that.
Okay.
Can I use it on the cover of my book?
Right.
And I expected him to name an outrageous fee.
Yeah.
But it turned out that it was rather ludicrously cheap to use one of his images.
Right.
And in fact, for the price that he quoted me, he said, you can not only use it on the cover... He said, I haven't even sold this one yet. You can have the original as well.
Wow, okay.
So go on Instagram and look at Shane Wheatcroft's amazing collages.
Right. So tell me about the book. You were going to tell me there are many stories attached to this book.
Yeah, well, each one, I think there's 101 poems in it. It's 103 pages and only two of them run onto more than one page.
Right.
101 poems that were composed for people in the street on demand. So most of the titles are the ones that I was given. And sometimes, well, a lot of the time, people don't really give me much information. I prefer not to hear about their mundane lives.
Right.
But on occasion, sometimes people do bring an interesting story to the table.
Right.
I've heard some very funny things, some heartbreaking things that people have told me and asked me to turn that into poetry. And often the really good stories are the... You know, they're not the best poems because the story itself is just too good to deal with. I mean, the story that they tell you, the way they tell it, ought to be just verbatim.
Right. But in what circumstances have you come across these people?
Oh, I'm just a magnet for that kind of thing. Yeah, people just come up to me and unload like I'm a therapist.
Okay.
Yeah, I had one guy who was about 85 years old, this working class London geezer. And he looked down in the dumps, distraught, and he said, I wondered if he could help me. I said, I don't know. What do you need help with? And he said he wanted a poem to give to the love of his life. And it turned out that the love of his life was his girlfriend when he was 18.
Oh.
And she had left him for another guy, a guy that he knew. And they moved away together.
Mm.
And about 10 years ago, 5 years ago, he decided to track her down and try and reignite the spark.
At the age of 75?
Yeah, 75 or 80, right. So like 60 years later. And he hired a private investigator and he got the address and he turned up at the woman's house and she was still with that guy,
right,
happily married. He knocked on the door and she told him to go away.
Right.
And he said... Can you write me something? Either I can't remember if it was to give to her or to make him feel better about that.
Yeah.
And obviously I said, well, I could write you something, but I don't think I can make you feel any better.
Mm. So you wrote a poem for him?
I did, yeah. Okay. That's not in the book, though.
Right, okay. Right.
It wasn't a very good one.
Okay. Well, it's a good story.
It is a good story. So I think when you have something like that, the key is to just keep it as true to the material as possible. Just retell the story honestly and let the material do the work. But yeah, that one's not in there.
All right. So what about one that is in there?
One that is in there is a woman came up to me and said that she wanted a poem to give to her husband who had left her for a prostitute from Kazakhstan. And I said, yeah, sure, that sounds like a great topic for one of my poems. And she said that, you know, it was a very seedy situation with sort of money and sexual favours and trying to get a visa to escape her what sounded like quite a tawdry existence in Kazakhstan. And then she showed me some of the WhatsApp messages that were intended for the prostitute, his new girlfriend, but he'd accidentally sent them to his wife.
Oh.
And she showed me all of these excruciatingly dirty WhatsApp messages that she had accidentally received.
Crikey, right.
So that was a good one.
So you seem to get the confidence of people. You have a way with you, presumably, of
I don't know. I think if you sit there for long enough, if you sit in any crowded place for long enough, people are going to come up to you and start talking to you.
I don't think so.
No? Never happened to you?
No, not quite, no. I mean, sort of in a bookshop, you do get sort of... I mean, I work in a bookshop, and you do get a succession of people. Most of them are just sort of people kind of rooting around looking for a £2 book. I must admit, I probably have been odd encounters every so often, but nothing like that. Not people sort of opening up in that way.
Yeah, it is almost like they're expecting something more therapeutic,
right,
than artistic,
right.
But I don't really buy into the whole poetry as therapy rhetoric.
No? Okay.
I mean, if they probably come to me thinking that it's going to be... I don't know how to say it. They probably come to me expecting something fairly sentimental or something a little bit naff.
Right.
You know, just a little...
Do you think are you articulating something for them that they...
They want me to articulate something for them.
That they couldn't put into words.
Exactly, right, yes. Right. And often it's very difficult when people, presumably quite shallow people, just want me to describe how they look. And I say to them, you know, that would be a very superficial poem.
Right.
And they sort of look at me with a blank stare as if to say yes. And I think, well, maybe a very superficial poem would be very fitting for your character.
Right, right.
But I try and avoid that. Okay. I try and do something which is a little bit more abstract, take the information or the story and take it in a more imaginative direction. Because the sign doesn't say, you know, biographer for hire.
No. Okay. Do you want to read something from your book?
Yeah, I could do. I'll try and find something that is suitable for daytime broadcast.
Yes.
How about... I will read one called Chickens and Eggs.
Okay.
A chicken is summoned from the pages of a recipe book to show us how to return ourselves to the egg. Hiroshima rematerializes, as does Nagasaki. Firebombs are inhaled from Dresden back to Coventry. France reinstates its monarchy. The Romans retreat back into their citadels. Jesus jumps off the cross. Adam tells Eve to put the apple back on the tree. Then what?
Okay. And returning to the name of your publishing, it's called Morbid Books.
That's right.
Is this because morbidity is a sort of an ongoing issue with you?
I guess so, yeah. I started out, I was going to do a record label back when my friends were in a band, and that was going to be called Morbid Records. And then there was no real planning to any of this because there was a gallery in France that wanted me to do a book for an exhibition. And I hand-typed this book, and at the last minute I was sort of putting it together, giving myself repetitive strain injury, trying to type out 100 books by hand. And I realised that the title page should probably have a publisher on it. And so I just typed the first thing that came into my head, which was Morbid Books, because it was called Suicide Notes.
Ah.
So I said Morbid Books. Right. Then I did another one, and I thought, well, I've got the publisher name now. It's stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not to say that everything is or will be morbid, but I think that certainly has, you know, I like the idea of language imposing meaning on you and you working within constraints. So that was, now the publisher is called Morbid Books, I think it is constraining me to a certain tint.
Okay, so it's influencing or might be influencing.
It's influencing the decisions,
yeah. The direction you might take.
Yeah.
But so you did a whole book called Suicide Notes.
Yeah, it was an art book. They were all individually typed with 20 poems in each, and each one had slightly different stuff in it.
Wow.
They were limited edition, obviously, because I could only type so many. I was going to type 100, but I think I ended up doing less than 50 because I underestimated how much effort it would take.
Right. And did you compose all the suicide notes?
Yeah.
Right.
These were the ones that I'd composed for people.
So in each case, if somebody approached you, I mean, run me through this because I'm trying to imagine.
Yeah.
Does somebody come to you and in all sincerity say, I need a suicide note, or it's a joke or what?
No, this was back when I had the sign that said suicide notes were advertised as part of my menu, so to speak.
Right.
And like I said, I think most people were into the idea of a dark joke.
Right.
And it was a good suggestion for people if they couldn't think of a title or a topic. Hey, maybe I'll commission this guy to write me a bizarre suicide note and see if there's any truth in it.
Right. So are they tailored for the individual? I mean, would each note be somehow, would it change according to the character of the person?
No, that's the thing. Once someone gives me a title and I sort of get in the zone, this is very much an interior process for me. I'm writing this purely based on what's going on inside my own head a lot of the time.
Right.
I might hear a snippet of conversation or something like with the time travel one where that might just implant itself in my brain and that ends up on the page. But this is an interior process, so
right.
They're commissioning something that's going on inside. It's more of a reflection of what's in my head than what's going on in their life.
Right.
But yeah, I can read you the first one that I ever wrote, actually.
Sure.
And this is where the bent spoon comes from, the logo.
Right.
So suicide note number one. In retrospect, hiring Yuri Geller for my 40th birthday party was a mistake. I know when Yuri was on Noel's house party, I marvelled at his ability to bend spoons with just his mind, and I admit that I rushed out and bought his book and joined his mailing list and paid over the odds for a cardboard cutout of Yuri that I kept by our bed for the duration of our marriage. But when he turned up to the barbecue and read my mind, he revealed to the world secrets that I can't handle being known.
Hmm. Hmm. Very good.
Thank you.
So, you are launching the book, your various publications.
Into the stratosphere.
There's an event tonight.
That's right.
At Housman's Bookshop. Which is that, King's Cross Road or
it's Caledonian Road?
Caledonian Road
in King's Cross.
In King's Cross, famous bookshop established, I think, in the 40s, possibly even before that.
Yeah.
As a sort of libertarian socialist publishers and bookshop.
Anyway, yeah, Radical Bookshop they call themselves.
Right,
which is great.
Radical Bookshop on Caledonian Road.
Yeah,
and you will be there tonight with Stuart Home.
I will be there with Stuart Home,
and you will be promoting and possibly selling even your publications.
That's the most important thing, selling them.
Right. Yeah.
I'll do anything to sell them.
Will you? Okay. So that's Poetry for the Poorly Educated and Stuart Holmes' new book, Send Cash. He has a lot of titles in print, I think, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. I was writing his bio the other day for the event, and I think it's 15 novels, several works of non-fiction, manifestos, magazines.
Right.
He's got a new non-fiction one coming out as well. So,
okay.
Yeah, he's a prolific guy.
Absolutely. And what's the format of this evening's event? Are you going to be reading or just launching or, you know, singing? Or
yeah, well, singing would be a good idea if I could sing. I mean, I thought about doing karaoke.
Right.
People are expecting morbid poetry and I'll go there and do some Kylie Minogue or something.
Right.
That would be shocking. That would be more shocking than the stuff that's in
the book. It would, wouldn't it? Yeah. What time does it start?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. at Houseman's Bookshop. So that will be Lewis Parker, writer and publisher, and Stuart Home. And you've got another publication here called Avoid, which apparently also came out in 2018. Are you on a bit of a roll at the moment? Is a sort of
I think I'm on a contractual obligation.
To yourself, because it's your own imprint.
No, I've got obligations to the distributor that I started a biannual magazine and I have to honour that commitment.
It has to be biannual.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, shall I read out some of these titles? There's various contributors. You Are the Editor.
Yeah.
It's designed by someone called Penny Metal, published by Morbid Books. One's called Tate Modern Bomber. By Alexander Art.
Oh, no, that's actually not by him, that's about him.
About
Although
him.
It's kind of by him as well.
Right.
That's probably one of the most interesting things in that or any other magazine
okay.
at the moment. He is a guy who I met while I was doing Poet for Hire outside the Tate, and I befriended him. I was going to do an interview with him because he was standing outside the Tate in this paint-splattered smock.
Hmm.
Sort of like abstract expressionist style, with a big sign on the front that said "Tate Modern destroys works of art," and he was a Russian guy.
Oh, is he? He's not the one that went in and did some damage to one, is he?
He didn't go inside, no.
Oh.
But he'd basically.
I thought there was somebody went in and defaced a Rothko. I think.
No, he didn't do that.
No, it's not him. Okay.
He basically approached the Tate and asked them if he could. Do some painting, I think, outside or in Turbine Hall, and they gave him a very chilly bureaucratic response.
Uh-huh.
And he was very critical of Tate Modern being available for hire for corporate parties,
right.
but not for independent artists.
Right.
So he stood outside there every day. He came here from Russia to stand outside the Tate every day.
Uh-huh.
And the Tate security seemed to go out there and harass him quite a lot.
Oh, right.
Even though he was on public land, which was really none of their business.
Yeah.
And one day he lost his rag, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, he went and petrol bombed the Tate.
Oh, dear. Which part of the Tate?
Outside, he threw Molotov cocktails at the Tate.
Okay.
And he got arrested, obviously.
As he would, yes. Should we move on quickly? I said earlier that you might be construed as cultural something or other. I didn't want to use the word even. But we got there in the end. Oh, it's Max Kaiser here, Casino Gulag.
Yeah.
That's a familiar name.
Max Kaiser used to have a show on Resonance.
Well, I think he still does, actually. I still hear his voice on Resonance. There's all sorts of contributors here. We've got Ask a Shamanic Communist by Stuart Home, The Drum Sander, George Russell, The Sick and the Damned Manifesto. So that's Avoid, issue 2,
correct.
Also published by Morbid Books. And where do people buy your books and journals?
Well, funnily enough, that one is actually available from the Tate.
Right.
And other independent bookshops.
Are they aware of the content? Probably not. Perhaps they haven't seen it. All right, so we are sort of rapidly nearing the end. Well, thank you very much to Lewis Parker, writer and publisher, for coming in. You can see Lewis this evening.
This evening at Houseman's
Bookshop on Caledonian Road. Website? Where's your website?
Morbidbooks.net.
Right. I think that probably about wraps it up. Or, of course, they can find you on the South Bank, can't they?
Yeah.
On a nice day.
Yeah.
You'll be near the Globe Theatre. Look out for the sign that says Poet for Hire. And
it might not be me. It might be a lesser mortal than me.
Right. Okay. But the money gets through somehow. I mean, it could be a sort of, you go and contribute £50 or something and you'll get a great poem.
I try not to let the money dictate the quality.
Okay, right.
In fact, most of them, even if you offered me £50, I would probably struggle to write one that was worth £50.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We could play out with a track. I brought this journal in, which you were quite intrigued by. It's called Typewriter 4, which I think was published in 1973 in a limited edition. And it came with a yellow flexi disc, which is poems by Bob Cobbing and John Furnival. And John Furnival was particularly known for his typewriter art. He'd create sort of big images like, you know, the Eiffel Tower or whatever it might be, the Eiffel Tower falling down, but sort of portrayed with typewriter fonts and so on. What's that one say?
Yin and Yang.
Yin and Yang, right. Okay.
That's impressive.
I mean, or you could, we've got a few minutes. I don't know if you want to read another poem or shall we just go with the flexi disc?
Let's go with the flexi disc.
Okay. All right, Lewis. Well, thank you very much for contributing to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.